This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow with beach weather upon us. The Sci-Fi Book Club is back from its spring break, ready for a little exercise outside, so to speak, compared to what our book is. Here with our book club, here with me, our book club regulars, Flora Lichtman, our correspondent and managing editor for video, senior producer Annette Heist. Welcome.
Hi, Ira.
Tell us about this. This was a really interesting book for couch potatoes, particularly.
I think we chose this book when it was about 3 degrees outside, and we were all ready to just even read about nature and possibly being warm. So the book is A Walk in the Woods, Rediscovering America on the Appalachian Trail by Bill Bryson. Came out in hardcover in 1998.
Yeah, a lot of people have read it, right?
I found that. I was reading it, and many of my friends had already read it.
Yeah. It is a very readable book.
It is.
I'll say that, right? It's very easy to read.
Two thumbs up for me.
Yeah,
I thought so, too. It was amazing. I mean, this really is about a walk in the woods. That's the title, and
right.
That is what it's about. And incredibly, you're glued to every page, or I was anyway. Mm-hmm. I really, these micro dramas of hiking, I was on the edge of my seat. Is he going to see a bear? Is he not going to see a bear? What about that moose?
He's so funny. I think that's what keeps you involved. But I felt, spoiler alert, even though the book came out in 1998, they don't hike the entire Appalachian Trail, and I don't mean that to be disparaging. I can totally understand why. I thought that's what it was going to be when I started to read it. And when they gave up in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, I have to say I felt relieved.
You felt relieved?
I did.
I didn't feel that way.
I felt like I was off the hook. Like, I don't ever have to do this either.
You thought if he did it, then you would have to do it.
It's been in the back of my mind somewhere for a long time that I would do that one day. And if I, like, the older you get, the better you know yourself. Like, am I really ever going to do that? And reading this book, I'm like, no, probably not. Like, I'm never going to go to Everest either, probably, after I saw the IMAX movie.
But I actually thought the best parts of the book were when they were hiking the trail. So Bill Bryson hikes the trail with his friend, Stephen Katz, who I think is, like, the book maker.
Yes.
I mean, every time...
Steals the show, as they would
say.
He does. I think that's the way to say it. Yeah, mm-hmm. He steals the book. Mm-hmm. And I thought those were the most fun parts of the book, by far, is when they were hiking together on the trail. So I was sad.
I missed him when he wasn't there. So they're supposed to make a movie out of this book. It's been in the works for a long time. And who would you cast as Katz? Any ideas, Ira? All right, I don't mean to put you on the hook, but I can tell you who they're thinking of for
who
Katz.
Who would I cast as... David Paymer.
David Paymer. that's you, isn't it?
No, it's
not. The guy that everyone says.
He looks like me.
Okay.
I'm getting even with him. I have
All right,
him
well,
cast
you can be the Bill Bryson character. Now, Nick Nolte is the person
talked
about
to
play Stephen Katz. I can, too, although these two men in the book are in their mid-40s, I think, when they set out. So Robert Redford as the Bill Bryson character and
he's
Nick
a little past
Nolte.
The 40s.
Oh, tiny bit, but he's Robert Redford. Who cares? Okay. So I can see it. But they've gone through a couple directors, so who knows?
Let's give out the number 1-800-989-8255 if you've read Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, or if you'd like to know more about it. But share with us what your thoughts are, you know, what it is. We already have a caller in. Let's get caller number one, Karen from Lebanon, Ohio. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I was so excited to hear that this was your book today because it's one of my all-time favorite books.
It is.
It's a great laugh-out-loud read, and it's one of the best audiobooks, too, with Ron McLarty as the reader. It's just absolutely terrific. I wanted to tell you just a little aside about this. Several years ago, I gave it to my dad to read because I knew he would really enjoy it. He would get a kick out of it. He read it, loved it so much. It was the year that he was turning 80 years old, and it became a bucket list item. He said, you know what? I want to walk part of the AT. So that summer on a family trip down to Gatlinburg, he wanted to walk the passage from Clingman's Dome to Newfound Gap, and it was quite fun, quite an experience. We'll never forget we even saw a bear right on the trail. So
wow.
Wow.
It was great.
Bill Bryson talks a lot about bears and being fearful of them in the book, so he saw one.
Yes.
And live to tell about it, obviously.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Karen. It was quite interesting. And regards to your family, do you think you're going to walk it at all? If your father?
No, I am. How old am I now? I think I'm 46. So I don't see myself as ever being a true hiker. But someday I would like to do just little bits and pieces of it, and you know, have a long weekend on the trail. I think that would be really awesome.
All right. Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend.
Absolutely. You too.
Bye.
So I'm going to gripe a little bit, because wouldn't people club without a gripe? right? Am I right? He loses
the scones
me.
While you're doing it.
When we get to Pennsylvania, I get kind of, I feel defensive about his descriptions of some parts of Pennsylvania. Here he is talking about it. He says, I never met a hiker with a good word to say about the trail in Pennsylvania.
I wonder why that is. That
I take umbrage with that. There are some nice parts of the trail, although I understand what in the part that he's talking about, it is an area around Palmerton, Pennsylvania, that's been ecologically damaged by a zinc smelting operation that went on there a long time ago. And a lot of the vegetation, most of the vegetation on the mountain was lost. And it does look sort of like a moonscape, but it's just a small part. There are other nice parts of Pennsylvania. He also says that it has, that part of the trail has the very worst maps ever produced for hikers anywhere. Useless, comically useless, heartbreakingly useless, dangerously useless maps.
Right.
And so that's my second gripe, is he talks a lot about the difference that a good map makes when you're hiking, which I completely agree with, but there's not a map in this book. I would have liked to have followed
good
along
point.
With where he was.
Hmm.
Good point. And, you know, there is a part in the book where right at the beginning where they decide they have to take literally the kitchen sink with them on their back.
Yes.
And they get rid of it very quickly.
Well, yeah. Cats does anyway.
Cats does.
By just throwing it
throwing
away.
Throwing things out.
Even as water,
trail.
Though, in some parts, right? And, like, important things that you might need, but that are heavy, like water. Yes.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah.
I like the way that Bryson writes about science. Can I read a little
sure.
a little bit of that?
Sure.
So he says, I'm no geologist. Show me an unusual piece of gray whack. I probably said that wrong. Gray wacky? Our listeners will know.
I'm sure they will.
They're correcting me right now.
Exactly. Tweets are coming in.
Or a handsome chunk of gabbro, and I will regard it with respect and listen politely to what you have to say, but it won't actually mean anything to me. And he just, he'll squeeze in some interesting science, but it's always accessible. I feel like you have someone who doesn't try to sound smart in this book to make it more accessible, and I really appreciated that.
He's also encountering everything for the first time, so I think he approaches it like that. Like, I'm not a geologist, so I'm going to explain or write about this for you who you're also not a geologist. So I think the language is very accessible.
Right, and then he also then goes on to explain it, which I love.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He's done his homework.
I think in some parts he has, not all parts, I would say. I felt like there could be just a little bit more information in some areas. I don't mean to be so critical of it. I did really like the book, but
No, it's okay. Because we have a guest, a special guest
yes,
we want to bring
do.
On. Towards the end of the book, he recounts a brush with hypothermia that he had in the White Mountains. And he says something interesting I think most people don't know. I mean, that hypothermia isn't what we think it is. You're not outside all the time and you're running around and getting cold.
Right. It's not when people set out on a frosty, cold, snowy day that they get hypothermia, because when people set out when it's really cold, they're prepared for the cold.
Yeah.
It happens when you set out on a sunny day, you start walking up a mountain, you don't know or understand that the temperature is going to drop when you get to the top, but it happens. And the White Mountains are notorious for those fast-changing weather conditions, and that's actually where Bryson writes about his brush with hypothermia. So our next guest surveyed some White Mountain hikers, and in his study published in the journal Wilderness and Environmental Medicine, he found that most hikers are underprepared for a day in the woods. Ryan Mason is with us. He's a fourth-year med student at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. How are you?
Hey there.
I'm great. Hi, Ira.
So let's get right to it. What are the things that they're taking that they shouldn't have, and what things should they take?
Sure. And let me just first, before I go through the list, I want to say that the ultralight community and people that do through hikes on these longer trails, the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, are going to have a completely different mindset about this, and my study was aimed at more at a day hiker or the average person hiking. So the New Hampshire Fish and Game and the White Mountain National Forest put out a list called the 10 Essentials, and they recommend that you bring these on every hike, regardless if you're out for an hour or 10 days. And so the items they recommend are a map, compass, extra clothing, rain gear, a way to start fire, a light as a headlamp or a flashlight, extra food and water, a pocket knife, a first aid kit, and a whistle.
A whistle?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why whistle?
Annette asked this similar question when I was speaking to her earlier, and it's actually for a location in case you're lost. You can imagine if you've ever yelled for a long time, your voice goes fairly quickly, and your voice actually doesn't travel that far. But if you're in a state where you're cold or injured or just exhausted and people are looking for you, a whistle is a very easy way to broadcast your location a good distance.
Well, I think that description says why you need to do these things, because if you're going out, you're saying to yourself, I'm just going for a hike. Why do I need any of this stuff? Right?
Right. Right.
So what did you find? What were people commonly forgetting to bring? Or maybe the first question we should ask or the next question is how many people were prepared with all of those things?
I surveyed 199 folks, and through in that whole group, about one in five people carried all 10 of those items.
Wow.
I relaxed it a little bit and called prepared, quote-unquote, as eight or more items. And about 40% people carried all eight, or carried eight of those items.
Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that one in five had a compass.
Yeah?
Me too.
Well, but you can't, being an old Boy Scout, speaking for myself,
yes, Ira.
You can't just carry a compass. You have to know how to use it.
Absolutely. Right. That was one of the limitations of my study. I wasn't sure, if you were carrying it, if you necessarily knew how to use it.
Yeah, and especially if you have a map and how to put it on a map and read it and all that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah, that's a whole new...
But I would imagine, I watch kids, I'm not going to say which kids, I watch kids today, and they just go out of the house with nothing on, they got their cell phone, don't worry, I'll be okay.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
And then they go on a hike and whammo.
Right, yeah, we actually found a lot of folks were carrying cell phones. They didn't report that they changed their hiking behavior because of it, as in, doing a harder trail because, I have my phone. But a lot of people, especially in the White Mountains because of the geography, don't realize that there's a lot of dead zones, pockets, where you don't get reception.
Mm. Now, dead zones will have a different meaning now.
poor choice of words.
It's a good choice of words. Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flato. We're with our book club talking about the book, Bill Bryson's book, A Walk in the Woods, and also talking about what you should take with you when you hike with Ryan Mason. Is there something, should park rangers or should the parks put out a little brochure right at the hiking trail, take this along with you if you're coming into the woods?
In New Hampshire, they do at basically any visitor center. You can pick up a pamphlet that clearly displays these. And at many of the trailheads, the starts of the trails, you can find which items you're supposed to carry. It's just a question of, you mentioned before, I'm just going for a hike, a day hike.
Yeah.
We found that really that perception is the problem, that people don't perceive a longer hike as being as dangerous.
No one's planning to get lost.
Or shorter hike, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah. And we should emphasize that the list that you gave was for the White Mountains. I think you told me that that's issued by a group, specifically for that area. If people are hiking in other parts of the country, they can consult with local hiking groups for what might help them where they are, like a snake bite kit maybe, depending on where you are.
I one essential that I take with me everywhere is some sort of windbreaker, because people don't realize
–
how much the wind really cools you off.
Especially after you're done hiking a ridge and you're very sweaty.
Right.
Yeah. It's a killer, so to speak, if you don't have it. Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me on.
Do you have a hike planned for the summer?
I'm hoping to climb Katahdin.
Oh, in
up
Maine.
In Maine, yeah.
That's the end of the trail, sort of.
Yeah, not the whole trail. I was just going to get up there and hike some of the wilderness up there.
Yeah, a lot of kids in camp do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a climb Mount Katahdin.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Yeah. Okay, well, good luck to you. Take those 10 things along.
Stay safe,
I will. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye. Ryan Mason, fourth-year med student at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. Wish him luck doing that.
Just relatedly, I loved the part in the book where Bill Bryson comes upon the person with the Enviro Monitor. Do you remember that?
Yes.
This measures 8 values: temperature, UV index, dew point.
The geeky hiker?
Very geeky.
But the guy's in like shorts and sneakers. He doesn't seem to have any gear, and he's hiking up the White Mountains, remarking on how the weather might change, right?
Yeah, but Bill Bryson sort of hands it to him. I feel like he's pretty, he has a lot of disdain for this kind of technology.
Let me see if I can get a quick call in. Colton in Baton Rouge. Hi, Colton. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Great show, Ira Plato. I've been waiting for the subject matter on the Appalachian Trail for a long time now, so happy to hear it.
Thank you.
My girlfriend, myself, and our dog hiked the trail last year.
Wow.
From Georgia to Maine. Now, we missed a small section, but I brought along a camera, which a lot of people looked at me and thought I was crazy for carrying the extra 7 to 8 pounds. And also our dog had a little camera on his backpack, so you have a kind of a dog's eye view. But this proved to be very difficult as far as the technology on the trail, because keeping things charged was just so difficult. That consisted of a lot of solar panels and just kind of stopping whenever you can to get an electrical outlet. I even carried a multi-plug. You plug it in one, and then you got 3 plugs and 2 USB ports. And people thought I was crazy for having that until we all only had 1 plug, and then suddenly everybody has their phones and their cameras all hooked up into my one little, half-pound plug that I carried along. But I feel Bill Bryson did pretty well. It's kind of amazing that he only did 600 miles and still inspired so many people to hike the trail.
Well, we're waiting, Colton, for your book to come out, the whole trail. That you
well, it's actually a film. It's called The Climb to Katahdin, and it was quite a journey because, having a dog on the trail is also a whole other thing, too, because there's only so many places you can stay when you really need a break in town that just don't allow dogs.
I believe it. Well, we'll look for the movie. Thanks for coming on with us and talking about it. We're going to come back and talk more about our book club after this break. Stay with us. 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at Science Friday, at SciFry. And maybe you've hiked the trail like he did without the cameras. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our Science Friday book club is in session, gaveling this section of it open. We're talking about Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, a good book to stash in your backpack, or maybe you just enjoy the hike vicariously from the comfort of a hammock or your beach blanket. It's a good spot to read that book, too. And we have some more reading suggestions for you. We asked you to submit your top book selections for our summer reading list, and lots of you sent in your suggestions. We whittled them down to a list of just 15. I think that could last the summer. You can find a list on our website at sciencefriday.com/summerbooks. And joining us now to talk about those books and some others that you might want to include on your summer reading list is Deborah Blum. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner and a professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin. And in Madison, she's written a whole bunch of books. Let's just pull one out. Say The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, are you lining up your summer reading list?
I am. In fact, I'm sitting here in Madison, Wisconsin, with stacks of books all around me.
Stacks of books. Well, let's get right to your stack. What's at the top of your stack?
Well, right now, and it's semi-related to the Bryson book, I'm reading a book called The Forest Unseen, A Year's Watch in Nature. And it's actually written by a biologist named David George Haskell. Uh-huh. It is such a beautiful book. He's a biologist in Tennessee. He takes just a square meter of old-growth forest, and he watches it for a year, and he uses this tiny little plot of land to sort of illuminate our world in the way nature changes. And I have it in front of me. Let me listen to the way he writes about lichen. Their radiance comes not from stone, but from mantles of lichens that blush emerald, jade, and pearl in the humid air. He's describing stones. I mean, every single page has this kind of poetry of nature in it. I love the book. Wow. So, but it's slow reading. I mean, it's hammock reading, right?
Sounds great.
It's beautiful. It's, you know, it's not intensely dramatic, but it's one of those books where you go, aren't we lucky to live here? It's that kind of book.
Well, let me give you my favorite book, and my daughter turned me on to this, and it's a science fiction book, but it has such great science overtones to it, and it's the Wool series, you know, and by Hugh Howey, and it's just a page turner, and it's a scary, scary science fiction book.
And I gave that to my son to read, and he was a bookseller, wasn't he? And he wrote it in his spare time.
He wrote it, you know, you get it on Amazon.
I think it's an
e-book. They gave it away for a year or so. It was free. And
first
then,
one's always free.
And now that there's parts 1 through 5 is the original series. Then there's 6, 7, 8, and now 9 is coming out in August, and I can't wait for the series. But it's just wonderful reading.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll go back and steal that from my son now.
Deborah, this is Annette. I know you like Brian Sweet Tech's book, My Beloved Brontosaurus. We talked to him a few months ago, and we wanted to play a clip from that interview.
Okay. Well, in the original papers, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who had named Tyrannosaurus Rex, he couldn't figure out, why this massive sort of deep-skulled, knife-toothed dinosaur would have such puny-looking arms, so he figured that maybe, during mating, the male sort of stroked or cuddled the female with these little arms, but you really shouldn't laugh at Tyrannosaurus Rex. You couldn't beat an arm wrestling contest with this dinosaur if you tried. Each arm could curl about 400 pounds.
Wow. So...
Keep that in mind.
Keep that in mind. Next time you face down a T-Rex.
What did you like about that book? I mean, it sounds enticing just from that clip. I haven't read it, but tell us what you liked about it.
It's actually, it's like a very small book, which appeals to some people, but it's so wonderfully smart and affectionate at the same time. I mean, think of the title, My Beloved Brontosaurus, which goes back to when we used to call the apatosaur the brontosaur and got the name wrong, and I think that even at one point put the skeleton together wrong, so it's got this fabulous sense of history of dinosaurs. And in this kind of journey in which he explains the way we see them and what they mean to us, he just illuminates what they are and how they thought and how they moved and how they looked. And he does my favorite dinosaurs, the stegosaur. Don't ask me why. I just love those little, those kind of wrinkly plates and the spiky tail. And so I was thrilled to have him talk about some of the cool things we know about that. It's just fun to read.
Mm-hmm. Our number 1-800-989-8255 if you want to get in on our book club talk and talking with Deborah Blum. Suggestions for books? What did our listeners say that they liked it?
Flora, go ahead.
I think one of the books on our listeners list and also on my own list was Mary Roach's book Gulp, which came out recently. And this was a book that was just filled with disgusting details about the human body, but it was fascinating.
You love to be disgusted.
Ooh, wow,
on
I clearly do, because I really enjoyed it. And we have a clip of Mary Roach to give you a sense, a flavor, so to speak.
Hydrogen sulfide, the human nose is exquisitely sensitive, able to detect less than one part per million. And a noxious fart would have in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 parts per million. But when you take it up to about 1,000 parts per million, hydrogen sulfide is fatal. It causes respiratory paralysis and kills people quite swiftly.
There you have it. Farts,
in
if they were in higher quantity,
glory.
Would be noxious, fatal. Fatally noxious.
I always had a feeling.
Isn't she great, though? And
she's
great. Like her first book, Stiff, about the science of corpses, was so wonderfully creepy and funny at the same time. Do you know what I liked about Gulp? And so this unfortunately says something about me. I think I was telling Annette this, is that at the start of the book, she sort of starts in your mouth and ends where it ends, right? In the digestive system. But she starts with spit and taste, and there's this fabulous chapter in which she's talking about pet food and how they make the different chemicals that they use to make pet food attractive to pets, what cats like, what dogs like. And, of course, in the way I think we relate to books, because, they speak to us in our own lives, I kept thinking about the fact that when I was a kid, I ate pet treats, those little Purina ones that were shaped like fake cheese and stuff. I started really worrying about myself after.
How did they taste?
True confessions on science.
Were they good? They taste good?
Yeah, you know, they were very bland, kind of crunchy and bland.
That was my question, too.
So they weren't worth the calories.
I can't believe I've never tried one.
So, yeah, I mean, I can't really recommend them. But I started worrying about what was actually in them, too, afterwards. I don't think they have the same sort of standard of
they may be healthier for us than fast food. You never know.
Yeah, the weather could be that. It's a wonderful book. You know, she just makes it so smart and fun. I'm a huge fan of her work.
She is fun to talk to as well. I think she's not only, you know, reading, she comes, her voice comes through in the book when you talk to her in person. She's, it just goes together so well.
Absolutely.
One of the books that our listeners chose for their top 15 is The Lives of a Cell. I've never read this mm-hmm. book, I'm almost embarrassed to say, but Deborah, I know that it's one of your favorite on this list. Tell us about that.
So The Lives of a Cell was written, about 50 years ago?
Oh, even? Yeah. I mean, it's something like that in the 50s. Yeah, I think it was in the 50s.
And it was written by Lewis Thomas, who was a doctor, an MD, and I love, it's a little book. It's really a collection of essays in which he looks at sort of tiny parts of what makes us alive, you know, and it's lyrical and beautiful. And I read it right, actually, very early when I was a science writer. I was thinking about being a science writer. And I think for a lot of people who write about science like me, there's always a book. This was the book that said to me, guess what? If you do it right, you can make science beautiful. Right?
He was sort of the Oliver Sacks of his time, if I remember mm-hmm. back. You know, a great scientist who could communicate very well what he was doing.
So that he'll even take, you know, a little hairy part of mitochondria, and you read it, and you go, well, that is so exquisite. And so I love the book. I think anyone who likes to think about how we tell stories of science should read that book.
And speaking of Oliver Sacks, I'd like to throw in Hallucinations for our summer book club list. I thought that was a really interesting book to read. It chronicles some of Dr. Sacks' own personal experimentation with drugs back in a different lifetime, I think. But it was fun. Did you read that book, Deborah?
No, I haven't. I've only read parts of that book. I have this kind of can't go wrong with Oliver Sacks kind of feeling, although just because I'm a chemistry geek, right? His Uncle Tungsten book is still my favorite.
Uncle Tungsten. It's a great book.
Isn't that a great title? Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's a great book.
Well, Deborah, I know you read Spillover by David Quammen. We have a clip of an interview we did with him. This is him on Science Friday talking about the emergence of a new virus that had killed 13 horses and a horse trainer. This happened in Australia in the mid-1990s. Let's hear that.
They isolated a virus from the dead horse trainer. And it was a virus they'd never seen before. They looked in the horses. They found the same virus. They gave it the name Hendra. And then they started on the detection work, trying to figure out where this virus had come from and how it had spilled over into the horses.
Wow. It sounds like that movie.
Contagion.
Contagion, yeah.
And it's a scary book in some ways. And that whole thing with Hendra and this mysterious deaths of horses, and then vets die and animal handlers die and they can't figure out what's going on, is the opening of Spillover. Mm-hmm. It's just this riveting opening where you're thinking to yourself, what is going on? And he uses it really well to set up what is my favorite part of Spillover, which is the fact that it places, he's looking at emerging infections. And you follow him around the world as he's sort of unraveling this story. And he goes into all kinds of, sometimes very risky places. But he's basically saying to us as we read it, look what trouble we're stirring up. We're going into these jungles that used to be left untouched. We're mm-hmm. marching into these caves. We're stripping away these forests. And these ancient viruses that have peacefully hunkered down in populations that we never got near, we're stirring them out. And then we're putting them on airplanes and we're taking them around the world. And so you really see him connect us both to our place in the natural world and to the reason that we're starting to see more of these viruses sort of leaking out of forests and caves. He does a beautiful job with that.
The name of the book again for people who now really want to read it is
Spillover
by
David Quammen.
This is Science Friday from NPR. You're listening to our book club, and we're talking with whole bunches of people who've read a lot of books. Deborah, do you read so many books? I mean, you're always reading books, and you're reviewing them. How many books do you read?
Oh, I've lost count. I always have to have. I'm like a book junkie, right? I have even the bed in my bedroom has this kind of ledge that goes behind the pillows, and I have stacks of books. I'm lucky I don't roll over and disappear under an avalanche of books.
Do you rather read e-books now, or are you still in the paper phase?
I do some of both, right? Yeah. If it's a book that and it's like this weird thing for me. If it's a book that I think I'm going to read once, I just as soon have it as an E, right? Mm. But if it's a book that I want to keep and read over and over again and stroke the cover and all of the things,
talk
right?
Over the pages,
yeah. Right. Mark it up and admire its physical beauty, then I want it in hardback. So I have a lot of hardback books. And, you know, I judge a fair amount of book. I was a nonfiction judge for the Pulitzer a year or so ago, and I'm a judge for the Penn E.O. Wilson Science Writing Award this year. So a lot of books come my way that way, too.
Mm. I wanted to ask you about a book that just came my way, Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Brainless Neuroscience. Have you read that yet?
In fact, I have it right here. I just got that. And I got it in part. Several of my science writing friends have just been buzzing about that book. And I think it's in part because there has been this kind of low-level disgruntled buzz in the science writing community that we make way too much of brain imaging and what it tells it. Oh, I took a picture of my brain, and now I know I'm going to go rob a bank next Tuesday kind of stuff, right?
Right.
And
it's lighting up.
Every week there's a study like that, I think.
So you think that we're putting too much, it's too a macro picture doesn't tell us a whole lot about what's
yeah,
really
that's
going
exactly
on.
Right. And this book, I mean, this is an interesting book because it's about half a kind of an essay to that effect. Oh, get a grip on yourself. You know, images of individual brains don't really tell us that next year's trend is pink Cadillacs.
Right.
And half footnotes. It's got almost as many pages. It's like a wonderful book for geek-loving, well, what's she really mean by that kind of thing? So it's got this fabulous back section in which she goes through study after study and, you know, article after article in which she says, does this really make sense? And, she'll take case studies. You probably remember Andrea Yates, the woman who had postpartum depression.
Killed her children.
Right. And she takes that study apart. You know, would imaging really have told us anything? In fact, there's no good images related to postpartum depression. So, you know, let's put in perspective what neuroscience can and cannot tell us in the criminal world. She looks at neuroeconomics. Mm. It's really kind of a fast, smart read with, like I said, the best footnotes section in the world.
And that was Brainwashed, in case people catch it. Yeah, Sally. Go ahead.
It's Sally Satel and Scott Lilienfeld. I hope I'm... Lilienfeld, am I saying that right?
I don't know. Sorry.
We never get names right here, so you fit right in, Deborah. Oh,
thank you.
Anyway,
thank
the
you.
Title's right. It's called Brainwashed.
The title is right. Well, And any upcoming books that are you working on, Deborah?
Well, I'm working on a book... please tell my agent and my editor that I'm working on my book.
She's working.
I'm working on my book, which is due at the end of this year, which is about the early history of poisonous food. Such a cool story.
Can't wait.
You guys are so great.
Yeah.
But it's about a fairly insane scientist who realizes that we've literally become very brilliant at making food, very chemical and also very poisonous, and is trying to stop it and is actually kind of a nut himself. So it's a really cool story, but it's also about poisonous food.
Fit right in. Thank you, Deborah, very much for taking time to be with us today.
It is always a pleasure.
Good luck. Good luck on the book, Deborah Blum, a Pulitzer Prize winner and a professor of journalism, University of Madison, of Wisconsin at Madison. And thank you, Flora Lichtman.
You're welcome.
We gavel close this edition. Do we have a book for next time?
ScienceFriday.com/summerbooks for some of the books that we just talked about. Web people worked hard on it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. We want to remind you that if you're in the Seattle area, we want you to come and see us on June 14th. So come out to Seattle at the Pacific Science Center. We're going to do our show from there. I'd like to have you in the audience. You can see Annette and, you know, see all of us out there. Drop by and say hello, and we'll hope to see you
in the audience. We'll pick a new book for next month soon. Keep tuned to our website.
Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.